This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. If you have found a new apartment in Seattle in the last year or so, you probably ran into the first-in-time law. It said that Seattle landlords were required to rent to the first qualified tenant. This is a first law of its kind in the United States, and yesterday that law was struck down. Here with me to discuss the pros and cons of the law and what we do next are Liz Dupuy and Chris Bennis. Liz is the former executive director of the Tenants Union of Washington State. Chris is legal counsel and former president of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Chris, you're a small landlord. What was your main objection to the law?
Well, we had a small building, 6 units, owned by my wife and my 3 kids, and was their college education fund. And when we have applicants come in, we like to meet them, learn about them, see if it's a good fit for them, for us, for the other tenants in the building, for the community. And taking that right away, the ability to manage our property in a way that no other city in the country has ever considered doing, we thought was just frankly, crazy.
What's an example? Give me a scenario where it was important to you to not rent to the first qualified tenant.
Well, the thing that when taking away the discretion of the property owner, what happened is we raised our rental criteria up, and it creates this pecking order where if somebody is the first one to show up and they meet those minimum criteria, you have to rent to them. You could have the second, third, fourth person in line with a more compelling story who says, gee, I make a little less money, but I'm willing to help out in some way around the building, or you just have a better feeling for them, and you can't rent to them.
What would give you a better feeling for someone?
Well, I'll tell you the exact opposite thing. We had a guy come to our building a few years ago who, at that time, you could use criminal background, you know, as a factor in declining their application. He said, I have these criminal convictions, but he told us how he'd become a pastor and turned his life around, and we decided to take a chance on him. Ended up being a great tenant, lived in the building for a couple of years. But when you have these absolute rental criteria that you can't deviate from because there's this locked-in pecking order of who qualifies and who doesn't, you can't give people a break. You can't make exceptions.
Okay. Liz, you heard an example there of Chris wanting to use his leeway to do the right thing. Why did you support this law?
We supported the law at the Tenants Union after numerous calls from tenants saying that landlords were doing the wrong thing. Indeed, landlords would say, yes, we have a unit available. And then a black person, a poor person, a woman, a single mother would show up to look at that apartment. And all of a sudden, that apartment is no longer available. So much so that for the last, five, maybe even more years, we've worked with the Housing Justice Project to look at discrimination in housing based on race, sex, and income. And so when this law came up, this ability to say, great, you have to qualify you have to rent to the first qualified tenant. We said, oh, that's fantastic, because that means that people, landlords, cannot use their implicit biases to be able to say that one tenant is just better than the other for one gut check or another. Yes, Chris is talking about maybe a good situation, but I don't think he's recognizing all of the different situations that can happen to have a landlord implicitly discriminate against a poor person, a young person, a person of color in these situations.
What about that, Chris? Would you acknowledge that this law is getting at the ability of landlords, who all of whom have implicit biases and explicit biases, that this was a tool to prevent discrimination?
What it boils down to is the cure worse than the disease? Yes, there is discrimination. There is unfairness in our society. We do have laws that are protective of discrimination against anything that was just mentioned. I was just talking to somebody yesterday and said, you know, we need education, we need enforcement, we need empowering tenants so they can advocate better for themselves. But to say that a property owner, let's say even somebody not like myself, but who has a duplex, who can't pick the person who lives 4 inches on the other side of their wall, I think the cure is far worse than the disease.
How would you empower tenants to advocate for themselves? So you're saying tenants, you prevent the discrimination. How
no,
could
I'm
a
not
tenant
saying
do
it
that?
On their own? Well, we have a city office of civil rights that enforces these laws that you're well aware of. You're working with them. There are dozens and dozens every year of fair housing cases brought against landlords for discrimination. I think all of us need to recognize we do have biases. And we do need to recognize them and be aware of them.
What's a bias of yours that you're aware of?
Well, I can imagine my family's Greek. If Zorba Afidopoulos came to rent from me, I might say, hey, Zorba, okay, maybe I'll put you at the head of the line. I can imagine thinking that. But I know for a fact that that would be discrimination on the basis of national origin or race or something like that. And I couldn't give Zorba that break under existing law.
Liz, would you acknowledge that there were perhaps unintended consequences of this now struck down law?
So we thought about the situation where a young person, maybe somebody with a lunch break, somebody like me who gets to work a 9-to-5 and has that privilege, possibly could see an open apartment and then be able to apply for it faster than somebody without internet access or somebody who possibly has to work, you know, 2 or 3 shifts. That is the unintended consequences I can think of.
Because this speed became important when you have to, when the apartment goes to the first qualified renter.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so folks who don't have internet access, folks who don't understand how to use internet access, you know, your elderly folks, your disabled folks who may not be able to get to the library, that was the unintended consequence that we were thinking of and that we considered a lot about. Saying that there's discrimination and that it's okay for it to happen because what is the alternative is absolutely abhorrent to us as representatives of tenants. We are ourselves tenants. I am a tenant. And I think that if my landlord were to be standing in front of me saying that, oh, yes, discrimination happens, but, you know, trying to fix it is going to breed to some bad unintended consequences, that's just going to make me not want to rent in that place. But with such high rents and such low places for us to go, how are we supposed to, you know, find a place where a landlord is going to say discrimination is unacceptable, period?
Same question to you, Chris. I asked Liz about unintended consequences. How were landlords reacting, working around this law?
Well, for myself, what we did is we greatly increased our rental criteria. We moved our credit score minimum from 550 to 720. We just basically made it so that if we have to take the first person who meets those criteria are going to be incredibly high. But not so much for myself, but for other small rental property owners. But what we saw is people either selling their properties, removing them from the rental markets, turning them into VRBOs or Airbnbs, or just only doing rentals through word of mouth, you know, small group of friends and family, so it never hit the internet, never hit Craigslist. But one of the things I want to talk about, getting back to this unintended consequences thing, what I saw happening is that this law created this frenzy, almost like a game of musical chairs, where everyone wanted to be first. So, you know, applying for an apartment or a rental house costs money, 40, 50 bucks to apply. And what I saw is you would get a bunch of people applying, trying to be first before they maybe even saw the place. And then you go through the entire screening process and say, okay, you're approved. And oh, well, they applied for 5 other places. They've already picked someplace else. And then you're starting the process all over again. It just really mucked up what I thought was a bad rental market and making it worse.
Is that true, Liz, the frenzy?
Oh, that frenzy's always been there. The low vacancies and the incredibly runaway high rents here in Seattle and throughout the greater Seattle area has caused this frenzy for years and years. I mean, I came here in 2013 of August, and when I moved here, I thought I'd be able to move to Seattle. I got into Seattle University School of Law. I was all about to go to law school. But no, I ended up in Everett because that was the only piece of housing I could find. And luckily, they had one of those instant approvals where you could sign up right away, have your background checked right away, and then be in. It was, as the lawyers and as the judge says is a bad thing, a complete transaction. I signed up. I got it. I was the first one. I don't know a single tenant that is going to shop around and not put in applications in this housing market, regardless of the law. That is just the way it is. You find what you can get. And add a layer of implicit bias, classism, sexism, racism, and all the other issues that go unspoken here in Washington State, especially in Seattle, and you end up with a terrible housing situation, a dire housing situation, regardless of this law.
Well, this law has been struck down, so now what? Liz, what is it going to take to bring landlords and tenants together in a better way?
I mean, it's going to be hard. We're going to have to go back to step one, back to where we work with Housing Justice Project and try and find knowing cases of discrimination, which is always hard to find because landlords don't have to tell you why they're not going to rent to you. Landlords can just not rent to you. And then you have to prove that they're the racist, the sexist, the classist to be able to get into that home. And then
so you run stings? Is that the idea?
We could do stings.
So, hey,
we could come up with another idea, another law. We can work with Seattle City Council to come up with something else. But at the end of the day, if we have to compromise with landlords, they are going to make sure that their profit interest, their right to choose, and their right to commercial speech, commercial speech stands above the human right to shelter.
Chris, is there a better way?
Let's, again, look back to the one simple thing. No place else in the United States has a law anything like this.
And there's racism everywhere else in the nation.
And so what we found is that this particular approach, saying that the rental property owner or manager has no say whatsoever in who they rent to or how they engage and communicate, that idea is unconstitutional.
And that is disingenuous. You said yourself that you got to create the rental criteria. You got to up them. If the landlord has no right to manage the property, then how can you change your rental criteria?
The question is, must you take the first person who meets some numerical standards?
Must you meet the first person?
Can you use some discretion to determine what is the best fit for you, for the community, for the neighbors, for the other people in the building? I think the answer is going to remain yes.
And I think that once you hit the first qualified candidate of those qualifications that you create, you should let people have their shelter. These are roofs over people's head. This isn't a friendship with you. This isn't a chance to make the community better. This is a roof over people's heads. If people weren't so stressed out worrying about where they're going to live tomorrow, next month, next year, maybe they would have a chance to invest in their community. Maybe they would have a chance to become better. But no, we're too busy working around your rules, trying to find our right to shelter amidst all the profit interests that you and your lobbyists have created.
The CNA Apartments is a little six-unit building in the Inner Bay area of Magnolia.
This is your place?
Yeah. The tenants are, you know, young people tend to be artists, musicians, stuff like that. All I'm saying is the guy in Unit 1 who's a drummer in a rock band and, you know, that may not be the best fit for everybody.
Why?
Because people should recognize that that building has a vibe and a community, just like what was that movie Singles here in Seattle about the building where, you know, all the young people live.
That was precisely the argument for racial segregation, though. A lot of homes and housing projects were made after World War II, after the New Deal programs, to be able to house a certain type of person. What you are arguing for is a certain type of person. That is exactly the problem that we were trying to address with this law.
So the drummers,
should be able to drum where they want. There are supposed to be laws that are supposed to stop those noise problems. I thought you said that there are a lot of different ways to fix those issues. So I'm not necessarily understanding why a certain type of person has to be screened and deemed okay by only the landlord. Can't the neighbor say, oh, your drumming is too loud? Can't the neighbor say, oh, I saw you smoking when you weren't supposed to, so I'm going to call the landlord. I'm going to get you a 10-day. Can't we all work together? Or is
what,
it really your job to deem what a landlord what a neighborhood should be.
What you're advocating for is a one-size-fits-all solution where everybody has to fit the same set of rules. I'm saying I might want to offer a property that has a certain amount of flexibility about rules like noise or smoking or
whatever. And then you put that in your rental criteria. That's what you do. But instead, you change your rental criteria and then argue that you shouldn't even advertise it. You are being disingenuous here. You're saying that you won't have any single right to try and police the type of person that's in there when you just said earlier in this segment that you were able to raise your criteria, to raise the credit ratings.
No.
You were changing the type of person that's allowed in.
We're beginning to bring this to a close. But how do you want to respond to that, Chris?
It boils down to one simple thing. Who is in the best position to manage their property, recognizing that there are laws that prohibit discrimination, there are tons of laws that advocate for rental property owners and tenants trying to balance their rights.
Okay.
What this has determined, what happened a couple days ago, is the simple ruling that the city of Seattle can't dictate and take away the ultimate right of the property owner to select who they want to do business with.
Okay, like it or not, that was roughly the ruling from this judge. The city has said it's going to appeal We'll see whether that happens. We've been talking about Seattle's first-in-time law, stating that landlords had to rent to the first qualified applicant, with few exceptions. Yesterday, that law was struck down as a violation of the Washington State Constitution. And we've been talking about it with Chris Bennis, Rental Housing Association of Washington, Liz Dupuy, former executive director of the Tenants Union of Washington State. Thank you for this.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll continue with The Record on KUOW in just a moment. If you're an undocumented immigrant, it matters where you live. A young firefighter in Tenasket, Washington, found that out the hard way. He lives hundreds of miles from the sanctuary policies in cities like Seattle, policies that likely would have changed his odds. Here's reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's Race and Equity team.
On a map of Washington, Tenasket is a tiny dot far north and center. From there, it's nearly 300 miles to Tacoma. That's the journey 20-year-old Noe Vasquez took in January in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. It all started with a traffic ticket, then led to nearly a month at the Northwest Detention Center.
My name is Ruby Amezquita, and I've known Noe probably for about a little bit over 2 years. He is dating my daughter, and he's just a really sweet young boy. I mean, he's amazing. He's really... Oh, he's gonna make me cry.
Her daughter Brenda gives her a hug. We're meeting outside the Tacoma facility on the day Vasquez was set to be released on bond.
You remember your first date that you guys, they went to a rodeo and they took their little sister. They took my daughter with them.
We were just friends that time.
Yeah.
that was where it started.
Noe Vasquez previously worked for Washington State fighting wildfires in the Okanagan Valley. It's a job he loves, and managers want him back. He's undocumented, he has no criminal record, and his story likely never would have happened if he lived in Seattle. Families cheer as a few detainees walk out, Vasquez among them.
Your mom's been calling.
Thanks for coming.
As we talk briefly, he still seems in disbelief that he's now facing deportation.
It's, pretty emotional.
And I'm sure you probably never thought this could happen to you, right?
No. And all my loved ones, they probably had it the hardest.
They're worried about you.
Yeah. Never thought it would escalate to this much, but I guess lesson learned,
The lesson learned for Vasquez starts with DACA, a federal program for immigrants who came here as children. It gave Vasquez permission to live and work here. But you have to renew it every 2 years. Last time around, Vasquez forgot a signature. He lost his DACA and his job as a firefighter. That set the stage for what came next, when Vasquez was pulled over for a traffic stop.
It's Frank Rogers, and I'm sheriff of Okanagan County.
Sheriff Rogers reviewed this case with me, and along the way was pretty candid about his own views on immigration.
My honest opinion on this whole damn thing, it's turned into nothing but a damn political stuff. You know what I'm saying? That's my opinion. And maybe we're in a different world over here. I mean, I'm not into all this sanctuary stuff. I mean, I don't know what goes on in these big cities. There's a lot of Hispanics that live here. We know a lot are illegal. We know that. Nobody cares.
He says, bottom line, officers don't ask about immigration status. So let's look at three key questions in Vasquez's case and why where you live matters. Question one, why was he arrested? Turns out Vasquez was driving with a suspended license due to an unpaid traffic ticket. In Okanagan, this can lead to a citation or an arrest. It's up to the officer. Compare that to Seattle, where prosecutors no longer charge for this minor offense and encourage officers to only give tickets. Sheriff Rogers sympathizes.
I know it sucks. You hate to see some of these poor folks that get deported. I mean, I know it disrupts lives, but it's just when you cross that line and get in trouble, then I don't have a choice. You're going to jail, and then what happens, happens.
Which brings us to question two. How do local police cooperate with federal immigration authorities?
We cooperate with all of them.
Rogers' county shares a border with Canada, so Border Patrol handles a lot of immigration enforcement here. Less than 3 hours after Vasquez was booked into jail, Border Patrol put a hold on him. When a fellow firefighter came to pay his bail of $500, it was already too late. How closely local police work with ICE varies by county, and easy access can be a factor. Sheriff Rogers.
As for the jail, Border Patrol goes down there. They're probably down there 2-3 times a week. They're welcome to come down there as much as they want. We don't care.
It's different in King County. The jail will only hold someone for ICE with a criminal warrant signed by a judge. And finally, question three. What information do jails collect? At the Okanagan Jail, they asked Vasquez where he was born. He said Mexico. The sheriff explained that any non-U.S. response triggers the jail to call Border Patrol.
Yeah, so the place of birth is like a neon flashing light that would be this like beacon flashing above my name.
This is immigration attorney Annie Benson. She recently worked with King County officials to pass an ordinance that stops the jail from asking this question. She says the aim is to protect immigrants like Vasquez, who may never be charged with a crime, and to keep this information out of ICE's hands.
This is not how we want our resources, federal, state, or local, to be used to break up families, to deport people who are contributing members of our community.
Benson calls King County's ordinance the strongest in the country in how it draws clear boundaries with immigration enforcement. Now she's helping to create custom versions of this policy for smaller cities and counties, places like Okanagan.
Yay, I'm so happy you're out!
Thank you, everybody.
Once outside detention, Vasquez blamed only himself for this ordeal.
And throughout the whole situation, it was just frustrating because I couldn't do anything from the inside. Everybody else had to help me from the outside. That's the most frustrating part of everything.
It's not a role he's used to as an older brother and a firefighter. Recently, Vasquez tried again to renew his DACA status, this time with an attorney double-checking the forms. He got it. He's eligible to work again. Soon, he'll ask an immigration judge to drop his case so he can get ready for another battle, wildfire season. In Tacoma, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Nearly 30 years ago, America met the Connor family.
Mother, this is very important. Our school's having a food drive for poor people.
Well, tell them to drive some of that food over here.
Mother.
2 cans, that's it.
Don't touch that cream corn.
Roseanne was a hit comedy about the struggles of a white working class family. It was unusual then. Now it feels even more relevant. Roseanne is back on ABC, and she's a Trump voter. Seattle TV critic Melanie McFarland just been writing about Roseanne and watching the new show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming. How is Roseanne 2018 different from Roseanne of the 90s?
Well, what you're saying about Roseanne being a Trump voter, Roseanne Barr is very famously and outspokenly a Trump voter.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely an air of kind of a Trumpian view of the world and the view of where we are, which is to say the way that the characters have developed in the intervening decades is to these extremes. However, the vision that we have of America as it stands now is mostly personified in Roseanne and her sister Jackie, who's played by Laurie Metcalf. Jackie is, the first time we see her, she is wearing her pink hat, she has on a pink Nasty Woman shirt, and they're just at each other's throats. But the interesting thing is that Roseanne is the voice of reason. And we know that when she says that she is the Trump, she voted for Trump, it's because of the jobs. That's what she says. She voted because he promised better jobs. And that's kind of an interesting soft sell of that side of the political spectrum, I think. And you don't really see the wingnut side. And depending on how you see Roseanne's view. I mean, but she's presented as a centrist
How does it work? How well does it all come together now?
I think
like, I don't know if I want people say, oh, I don't want politics in my football national anthem. You know, does America want politics in their Roseanne Barr revival?
Well, that's the question, right? I mean, enough people tuned in with enough of that nostalgic recollection of the original.
18 million
viewers. I mean, that's huge for any show on broadcast this year, this season.
This was 2 days ago.
Yeah. And actually in recent history, you know, 18 million for any broadcast show that isn't NCIS or The Big Bang Theory is pretty huge. You know, I think that it's one of those things where the politics is unavoidable. Part of that is that because of its star, there's a certain segment that's always going to conflate Roseanne Barr with Roseanne Conner. But also, if you look at what Roseanne the series is, it's the whole point of the series is to kind of speak to mainstream America, its concerns, the things that we have in common. And so I don't know whether this new series does that initially. I think I've seen 3 episodes. There's 9 in this season. I'm guessing that a pickup is inevitable, and I'm guessing that ABC will expand that order for the next season. But I would say that it really gets back to the heart of what the series was about, which is, you know, speaking to the concerns of Americans who have issues making ends meet. There's a lot of discussion about health care. That's actually a huge theme this season, and that takes on some interesting tones as it moving forward. But it's a lot about people who are just struggling to live at this point. And that's a lot of what the original episodes were about as well.
So jobs, health care, what other hot button issues 2018 is Roseanne dealing with?
So here's something that's interesting in past episodes, and I can't even say original because it's still an extension of the series. Past episodes, one of the things that Roseanne got a lot of credit for in the late 80s and 90s was taking on sexual orientation and bringing those issues into the Conner household and setting it around that kitchen table and actually, you know, making it personal. So if we're looking at politics, the original series actually covered a lot of politics, but it brought into the household. And I think that's one of those things where a lot of discussion now is the whole idea of we have part of that divide is that we don't look at how politics, we may take look on an issue, a social issue as a political issue until it comes into our household. One-on-one, I think there's a lot more acceptance than on the national level. And that's something that Roseanne is kind of looking at now without actually addressing it in a fundamental way like those original episodes did. So originally there was a lot about sexual orientation. Now there's a character, actually it's one of her grandkids, who is a boy who wears on one episode a sequin skirt to school. So there's questions about gender fluidity and gender identity. And Roseanne and Dan have issues dealing with it, but eventually they come around to an understanding a little bit, if not full-on acceptance.
Okay, so yeah, an understanding can happen in the house among people who know one another, not just shouting on Twitter.
Right.
Well, there are other network TV sitcoms dealing with politics. There's an ABC show, Blackish. It centers on an upper-middle-class African-American family. They devoted an episode to the election.
You think I'm not sad that Hillary didn't win? That I'm not terrified about what Trump's about to do? I'm used to things not going my way. I'm sorry that you're not, and it's blowing your mind. So excuse me if I get a little offended because I didn't see all of this outrage when everything was happening to all of my people since we were stuffed on boats in chains.
Oh, how would you compare the Roseanne approach to something like that?
Well, funny you should ask that. So Roseanne actually has a black granddaughter now, and we know that. And we know how she feels about that because she has a friendly interaction with a black granddaughter, and that's it. When I watched it, I kept on thinking actually of a line from another favorite sitcom of mine called Ab Fab, where the character Idina Menzel was elated to know that her daughter was going to have a black granddaughter because she said, oh, that's the ultimate fashion accessory. And it seems like, and this is one of the issues that I have with this new Roseanne, there's a lot of this idea of, see, this is this blended family where we're covering all these things and we relate to all of these things, but it's never talked about in a fundamental way and never shown that there is any kind of issue that needs to be discussed unless it's the easy issue. And I wouldn't say necessarily that gender fluidity is something that's easy to talk about, but I also think that seeing that grappled, that issue of identity grappled with a one of her white grandchildren, it was probably easier for the writers to tackle than necessarily going into the politics of having a black girl as a grandchild. And again, we're only in the first three episodes. That may come up later. But again, this goes back to that whole idea of the whole Trump view of the world where, oh, it's not really worth talking about. It's not really worth addressing in a fundamental way. We're going to skip over this because there are other things to be worried about.
Talking with Seattle TV critic, she writes for Salon. This is Melanie McFarland. You, unlike me, you're not old enough to have seen All in the Family when it was live. Maybe you've seen the reruns, but I wonder how it compares with that because it had a liberal spin to it from Norman Lear, but I remember it as being popular across the board because liberals loved that Archie was getting his from Michael, but cultural conservatives loved Archie Bunker too. Mm-hmm. I think. So I wonder, who is this show for? Do you have to be somewhere on the political spectrum to enjoy this show, or how is it embraced?
So that's something that I don't have the answer to that question. I think I'll have a better answer once we're further into this 9-episode run. I think the difference with All in the Family is that you did have each of these sides. And again, this is the issue with Jackie being, you know, in future episodes, she is this parody of she's a life coach and she has the answer to everything. And she's this parody of liberalism that you don't really see the other side of. However, and this is something that another critic pointed out, and it's important to mention, Sarah Gilbert is an executive producer on this series. Whitney Cummings is also one of the writers. So there are representatives in that writer's room that are definitely having an influence on the tone of the series, just as
these are progressive, well-known progressives.
Yes. And so, you know, so in these opening episodes, anytime that you see a first episode of any series, and really this is, even though it's an extension, it's really an introduction to a lot of people of what it is now. It's a calling card as establishing this is what the show is about, which is why the political overtones and particularly the divisiveness is kind of interesting. And it'll be interesting to see how that is sublimated through the rest of the series. But right now, as it stands, you have Roseanne and the title character really kind of looking at America. It's like, can't we be united in this vision where we don't have to talk about this stuff that divides us unless we absolutely have to? So for instance, to go back to the son, the grandson, they had to talk about it because he was getting beaten up in school, or he was going to a new school and he was probably going to be a target for bullying. They were establishing that. So we can all agree that bullying is bad, right? So that was part of it. So these kinds of things, these issues that are coming, there's another issue coming up related to healthcare, and I won't go into it because it takes a major turn in the series. That again, this is something that's facing all of us. So it may be a little bit much to expect Roseanne to cover everything in these first few episodes. But in terms of what All in the Family was able to do, it's not quite there yet. And I don't know if it'll ever get there.
What other network show could come back as a revival? What's next?
Well, you know, so I'll tell you what actually is coming back. So CBS has done a bang-up job of bringing back brands. So you already have MacGyver back. You have Hawaii Five-O back. Magnum P.I. is coming back.
Uh-huh.
So I think that those
who
are...
Who was that guy with the mustache? Selleck. Is it Tom Selleck is in it?
Oh, gosh, no. Oh,
okay.
No, he's already in Blue Bloods.
Oh.
So, I mean, that's the question. I mean, it's interesting. Earlier, I was talking to one of your producers about the fact that there's a deadline headline on the internet right now saying that Hollywood is soul searching. I was like, no, I don't know that they're soul searching. I think that there was a prediction that this was going to be at least a huge debut because Will and Grace has come back so successfully. The X-Files came back relatively successfully. People really want to see these old shows. There's an element of comfort and knowing what they're about. And particularly in this era where we have, you know, hundreds of shows debuting every year, So I think that to answer that question, there are any number of series that I think will be interesting to see come back. Another one that's coming that I'm very interested in seeing, Murphy Brown's going to be coming back with its original cast.
Candace Bergen.
Yes. Okay. So if you're looking at Roseanne, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I can't take this. Maybe Murphy Brown will be your show.
Will she be a single grandmother, and will there be controversy around it?
Who knows?
Melanie McFarland, a TV critic for Salon. You also grew up here in the Northwest, and you just brought up basically the idea of comfort food TV.
Uh-huh.
We're about to talk about some food in Seattle, possibly comfort food. The discussion is about what Seattle's signature dish should be. Any thoughts? You want to chip anything into that?
Oh, my goodness.
You can stick around and talk about it?
Sure, I can stick around and talk about it. I will say this, and I realize that this may be throwing down with some people. Seattleites, don't try and do Chicago pizza. I know that there is a place that is doing it. I haven't tried it yet, but I have been here for 20 years, and I've tasted certain versions of what is supposed to be Chicago pizza. And no, don't. Just don't.
Just don't.
Stop trying.
Okay.
Do it.
All right. A Seattle signature dish. We're gonna name it. Or maybe it's too late for one. We'll get into all that in just a moment. Melanie McFarland, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll get back to the record in a moment. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Would you go to New Orleans and not eat jambalaya or gumbo or beignets, some signature New Orleans food, deep dish in Chicago, thin crust in New York, Philly cheesesteak, buffalo wings? What do we want to be Seattle's signature dish? And before you yell salmon at your radio, I want you to hear from my next guest, Naomi Tomke. Naomi is a Seattle food writer, and she's here to argue for a dish that has the potential to be Seattle's trademark dish. We also have a TV writer, Melanie McFarland, who was just talking about Roseanne. And I think corn chowder came up at Roseanne. Well, let's stick around and talk about Seattle's signature dish. Welcome, Naomi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is your Seattle signature dish nominee?
So I am nominating chowder fries, which is a fairly new dish, but it just incorporates Seattle's amazing seafood, and it's just a very approachable, fun dish, and I think we need that.
Chowder fries. So that sounds like poutine, gravy on fries, gravy and cheese curd. They do that in Canada, right? So this is...
It's extremely similar. But the other thing is it's a lot just like chowder. Chowder has potatoes. This is just the potatoes are in a different format, a fried format, which usually makes things taste better.
I get that Seattle has good seafood for chowder, but what's local about French fries? Or is it just, does it matter? Does it matter?
They're just delicious.
They're just good. Okay. Any French fries?
So
what about JoJo? Isn't JoJo's a Northwest thing? You know what JoJo's are?
Yeah. I've heard that they're a Northwest food. I don't know that much about them.
Melanie, do you know anything about JoJo's?
Oh, I know about some JoJo's in terms of how delicious they are.
I don't think they call them JoJo's outside of, they're potato wedges, right?
Right.
Yeah. But I think that's a Northwest thing to call them JoJo's.
I think they'd go great under some clam chowder. I think they'd work well in this dish. Maybe we've developed the new idea.
It's happening right now. You're listening to it come together. Naomi, are you inventing this or is chowder fries already quietly happening here?
I am definitely not inventing this. Okay. Where have you
eaten it?
So the first place I saw doing it in Seattle was White Swan Public House, which is a seafood restaurant on South Lake Union. And they call it the poutine of the sea. And it comes, it's very
there you go.
Cute. It comes with whole clams on top. But they and all the other chefs I talked to that serve it here in Seattle all had seen it somewhere else. So there are pockets. One had seen it in Southern California and one had seen it in Astoria, Oregon. So there are other places doing it. But I feel like there's a real opportunity for Seattle to take a hold of this dish.
Well, Melanie, here you're just learning of this, it sounds like. What do you think? Chowder fries.
So here's the thing about chowder for me, from a TV perspective. Of course, we think of Mayor Quimby going, chowder.
Yes.
All the time.
New England has it.
There you go. Exactly. I enjoy a good chowder. That said, one of my favorite shows on TV is The Good Place. And one of the clues that something was up with The Good Place, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, you need to see it. stream it right now, is that one of the versions of The Good Place has a chowder fountain.
I've never heard of a chowder fountain.
Yeah. So so there are all these different foods in there that are supposed to be these symbols of paradise, and one of them is a chowder fountain.
Chunks of chowder
seen
flowing?
The chowder fountain, but just picture, just take a moment.
Oh, I am.
Chowder fountain.
Okay. Well, so, you know, it does sound, actually, chowder fries sounds like a mess, Naomi. How would I eat chowder fries?
It is not a neat dish, but I mean, I think you employ a fork.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that you can dive in like you would with French fries with your hands.
Okay, okay.
Is it a justification of a spork?
That would be an ideal tool, I think. At White Swan, at the Poutine of the Sea, it has like whole clamshells and sort of it's a little bit messy, but All Water downtown serves it in this sort of tureen, and it's very elegant and tall, and it makes it very easy to eat with a fork and not get chowder everywhere.
Well, why is this better than salmon as a signature dish? Salmon.
Salmon is great, but when people come here, they want to try Seattle's food. Salmon exists, not as good elsewhere, but it exists, and they know what it tastes like, and they want to try something that they can get here that is of the city. And I think that we need a seafood dish that does that. People go to New England and they have fried clams. They go to San Francisco and they have cioppino. And they go to New Orleans and they have gumbo. And all of these things highlight the seafood. And in Seattle, they come here and they're all just sort of very ordinary, unembellished versions of the seafood. And I think that it would do a service to them to try something more interesting.
Melanie, would you take your tourist in-laws to get chowder fries in Seattle?
Knowing my tourist in-laws, if I took them to get chowder fries, I think they would stare at it.
Mm.
But I think that they would kind of nod and maybe take a picture and take it back to Rockford, Illinois and say, look at the wackiness that goes on in Seattle. These are chowder fries.
But you can't carry it around Pike Place Market, right? Like a lot of the great signature, you know, cheesesteak and deep dish pizza, that's finger food.
I mean, it's no harder to eat than a cioppino or a gumbo.
Mm-hmm.
You're still employing both hands for this.
True. True. Does a signature dish need to be comfort food? Is salmon just too much of an ingredient, too elemental, but it's got to be comforty to catch on?
I think it helps. You know, it helps make it more approachable. You know, in an ideal world, our wonderful raw oysters would be a signature dish. But
yeah, there you go.
My Midwestern in-laws are not necessarily, you know, scrambling to try the next oyster when they're out here. Mm-hmm. They are, however, scrambling to try chowder. So this is sort of a more unique way for them to try it.
Yes, mm-hmm. With the JoJo's. Any other suggestions, Melanie? What would be a Seattle signature dish?
You know,
do we need one?
Yeah, and so that's the question. I mean, we have so much great fresh food out here that maybe it's just the signature freshness of everything.
Ooh,
as long
good.
As nobody tries to do something like make a signature dish out of taking tuna casserole and making it salmon casserole, which, no, don't do that. So that and Chicago-style pizza, don't do those things.
Okay.
That's all I ask.
What if it's too late for us to have a signature dish? I mean, New Orleans had jambalaya for, 150 years or something. Does it have to be historic? Can you make a new, a modern signature dish? Or does it just seem like, what's the Mean Girls thing you're trying to make?
Don't make fetch happen.
Stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not a thing.
That's right.
I mean, a lot of signature dishes are much newer than that. New Orleans is a very old city, but, you know, the cheesesteak isn't that old in Philadelphia.
Mm.
Pat and Gino's, it came out of that rivalry. So, you know, if we get a couple places doing chowder fries across the street from each other, I think it can zoom right up.
Mm-hmm.
What about the idea of planking things, though? That seems to be a Northwesting. Would that be kind of a strange suggestion?
Plank it. That's our catchphrase.
I don't think you see it that
often. Put a plank
often.
On it.
And I also don't think it does great things to the salmon. I love salmon, but I'm not sure that is the best way to show off.
Controversial. I like that. Why does a trendy food catch on versus fade away? Because, you know, why? Yeah, well, let me stop there. Why does that happen, do you think? What makes something like fetch is not happening, but some foods actually do?
I think part of it is you have people doing a good job with it and then people iterating it. So not only are people making chowder fries, but they're making Dungeness crab chowder fries, and somebody else is making chowder fries with JoJo's, and all of a sudden it becomes part of the cultural literacy of being here is, oh, I like this chowder fries, and I'll argue for them in a discussion, and oh, this guy's doing this and has improved it, and it gets better and better, and people start to have strong feelings about where you should get it, and then I think it starts to stick around more than just flash in the pan.
We need to argue about it.
That's what I'm
saying.
That's
a good sign. A listener named Jeff in West Seattle writes to say, hey, Bill, I was born in Seattle, vintage 1955, and never heard of this cream cheese hot dog until the 1980s. My understanding is it was created by some downtown business guy from New York. See, he's arguing. For Chicago, who wanted to create some, quote, local food to sell to the tourists. It is not a Seattle thing, but just a fake news dog.
Oh, why?
What do you think?
I actually think his timeline's off. I think it's even more recent than that.
Yeah, I only learned about it much more recently.
Yeah, I've read a history. Hannah Raskin, who used to be at The Weekly, did sort of an oral history of it. And I think it's even more recent than that. But it's, you know, people like to make statements. It's not a Seattle thing. It's a Seattle thing. It's everywhere. Every hot dog stand in the city sells it. And no hot dog stand anywhere else does. So whether you like it or not, it's a Seattle thing. I happen to think it's really good.
But so why are you elevating chowder fries? You're saying we have a signature dish, and it's cream cheese on a dog.
Well, I want a signature seafood dish,
okay.
Most importantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's fair.
But I also think having a signature hot dog is different than a signature dish. I think it's a subcategory of signature dishes.
I agree with that, because everybody has their version of the case meats in every single different city. So, yeah, if we've got to get cream cheese, then that is our lot.
I think it's not you're not a real city until you have your own hot dog, right?
How about we don't put the seafood chowder on fries, we put it on Northwest morel mushrooms, chanterelles. You put Washington apples in the seafood chowder. Am I going anywhere?
No.
Okay.
Stop now.
Okay.
I think Washington grows a lot of potatoes. I think we can do it with the French fries.
Okay. Okay. Naomi thinks it's going to fly. Melanie, you seem like, well, let us know, Melanie, when you bring your out of town in-laws in, let them know. If you give them chowder fries, I want to know what they
think. I will take footage.
Okay. If we don't live near a chowder fry restaurant, can we go to Ivor's and just dip Ivor's fries into Ivor's chowder and start to make it a thing?
You can literally just pour your chowder over the fries.
Uh-huh.
So Pike Place Chowder, which is in the market, has fries at their Pacific Place location, and when they decided to do it, they literally just poured the chowder right over the French fries.
You can hear it going glug, glug.
I know.
Naomi Tomke, Seattle food writer. Her latest piece on Seattle's signature dish is in Thrillist. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
TV writer Melanie McFarland, she eats too.
I do.
And we're all considering signature dishes together. Thanks for talking with us, Melanie.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning into The Record. The show's made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Coming up tomorrow, The Week in Review, this week with Kate Riley, Essex Porter, and Dave Ross. We run down the week's top stories and get you smart about the week gone by. So tune in then. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.